History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And what we've learned is they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and then invest a little time to patiently listen as memories from long ago take on new life in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. 78 years ago this weekend, a small volcanic island in the Pacific became the battleground where more than 6,000 American Marines would make the ultimate sacrifice. A fight expected to last just a few days would stretch out for 5 weeks. I'm referring, of course, to Iwo Jima, where more than 100,000 American troops were involved, very few of whom remain with us today to tell the story. We have the privilege of visiting with one of them, and that in itself is a bit of a miracle, as we'll hear from Jim Friel, who will celebrate his 100th birthday at the end of February in Topeka, Kansas, where he once served as police chief. February 19th, 1945 is a date that he will never forget. That was the start of the fight for Iwo Jima, and also the day Jim acquired a souvenir that he hasn't been able to get rid of since. It's still lodged inside his neck, as you can see in an x-ray image on the wall of his Topeka home. We're going to get to all of that. But as always, we like to start at the beginning. So Jim, what do you remember about those early years here in Kansas's capital city?
Well, you got to remember that in the 20s and 30s was the Depression era in the United States, and nobody had any work. And the average wage was $1 a day, 6-day weeks, 10-hour day, and that's 10 cents an hour any way you figure it. So there wasn't much opportunity to do anything except, of course, if we were kids, we were sent to school. My mother insisted on that. My brother and I didn't want to go to school, of course.
Were you the oldest of the five?
I was the oldest.
Does that mean you got the best chores?
I had a good life. You know, my mother insisted that we go to school. But you see that one of the drawbacks at that time, there was no vaccinations for anything. Mumps, measles, and chickenpox and all that stuff. You got it. You were out of school. So while you're out of school, there was nothing you do. You had to stay home. You're quarantined. So that's where I learned to read and learned to love to read. So, you know, everything has its benefit.
So you learned to read because you got sick.
Right. It's just something to do.
What kind of stuff did you read back then?
I loved history, especially American history. And if I could have been born in a different period in history, I would have loved to have been born when the West was expanding. Can you imagine this country out here with nothing but you get on a horse and go any way you want, no fences, no roads, no nothing, just go. And there's a lot to see in this United States.
Now you got that song, Don't Fence Me In, running through my head.
Well, you know, that's pretty explicit of what we thought about. But, of course, at that time, there was song, wasn't there?
Well, and you mentioned the Depression. And, you know, most people alive today didn't live through that, have never seen anything like that. What are some of the things that you remember that would maybe get our attention today?
Well, when the stock market crashed in 1929, the banks all went bankrupt and everything. It was just a depression. People actually committed suicide and everything else as a result of it. The roads were filled full of bums looking for work. That's when the Okies and the Arkies and the Missourians all went to California, you know. Mm-hmm. But they all called them all Okies and Ma and Pa, Clampett and all that bunch, you know. That was a time of life. And the railroads were filled full of bums hitching rides to California, which, you know, God has a way of doing things. He put those people out there when the war broke out and they had work for the aircraft factories and stuff.
Well, and I'm just curious, for your family, are there things that you had to do to get by that didn't seem like a big deal to you then?
My dad was a laborer and had no trade or anything, so he just took whatever work you could get. And up until the 30s, when Roosevelt took over, That's when things first started moving up. They had all those federal work programs and the WPA and NRA and all that stuff.
And how did you get along with all your siblings?
I got along with them fine. We had disagreements, but, you know, it was a good family.
And Bill was the closest to you in age?
Yeah, he was 14 months younger than I. And my next brother was 8 years younger than me.
So I'm just guessing, you and Bill probably did a lot of things together.
We did everything together. Just grew up together.
And do you remember, as a boy growing up, having some thought in your head, hey, when I grow up, this is who I'm going to be or what I'm going
to
do?
Just wanted to exist.
And you liked baseball, I understand.
Well, yes, that was the American sport at that time. You know, we didn't have football and basketball and all that stuff. It was there, but it wasn't a national sport like baseball was. And the St. Louis Cardinals was our team because that was the closest national or American League team that this close. And then later listened to Dizzy Dean broadcasting the radio.
Did you have a favorite ball player growing up that you liked to hear about with the Cardinals?
Oh, the Cardinals, Dizzy and Daffy Dean and Marty Marion and Enos Slaughter and a bunch of them. I can't remember them all.
And you played a little bit?
Well, yeah, but I wasn't good enough to make the first team in high school. I play intramural, whatever that means. You're just not good enough to do anything but make up teams.
And I don't want to leave anything out, but I know you graduated high school in 1941. What'd you do after you graduated high school?
Well, like every other summer, I went to work on a farm. My grandfather, both of them were farmers. And summers we spent on the farm, and I love farming. I love the outdoor life, and I didn't ever want to work in a factory. We'd sit there on a desk or table or bench or whatever and assemble something. That didn't appeal to me.
Is that something where you and Bill would go together and do that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We're pretty close.
And what were some of those jobs you'd have to do on the farm?
Well, put up hay and help thrash and everything that a farm boy does.
And it seems to me, of all the people your age that I've interviewed, almost everybody has some kind of memory about December 7th, 1941, and how they found out what happened. How about you?
My brother and I were staying. My parents were gone. They'd gone to one of the grandparents and left us at home alone. At that time, we were living up here at McClouth in a little town where my dad had been working. And listened to the radio, listened to Dinah Shore singing St. Louis Blues. They interrupted the show to announce the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Nobody knew where Pearl Harbor was. I'd never heard of it before. Of course, didn't get the papers for a couple of days later and found out about it. And my brother and I both wanted to go right away, but of course, Mom wouldn't let us.
Can you help us understand how jarring or alarming that news was?
Well, no, we didn't have any idea where Pearl Harbor was or what it meant to the country. At that time, Hawaii was a territory. It wasn't a state, of course. Nobody from our part of the country had been to Hawaii. Or, you know, it was just something new, something way off someplace.
Had you guys read about the Marines? Did you know who the Marines were?
Only that they were different, and we joined the Marines because they were different. And the reputation that the Marine Corps has. And that we figure they were the best, and I still feel that way about the Marine Corps. First to fight.
And in your family, Bill was first, right? He went in before you?
Before I did. I don't really know why, but I wanted to finish high school, and I did.
When did you decide to go in and why?
As soon as my mother would let me. You know, back then you didn't do what your parents didn't want you to do.
That's a pretty deep statement right there. There's a lot to flesh out there. But as far as the Marine Corps goes, you know, I'm aware that you're one of the last men alive who can tell us the story of Iwo Jima, who was there yourself for the battle. But there's even a smaller number that were involved in the Marine Corps' first paratrooper unit. And you're one of those guys, too.
You know, he got jump pay for that. We got $50 extra a month. As enlisted people, officers got 100. Well, they got 100 more than we did, but that's the officer's privilege. But we never jumped in combat. We trained and went in and landed just like regular Marines from Higgins boats.
Yeah, and if you can, maybe walk me through the early part of your Marine Corps journey. Did you know what you were getting into? What were some of the things in training that maybe got your attention a little?
Well, you didn't have time to think about anything because they kept you so busy. You kept you going from daylight till, you know, after dark. And everything was regimented. You weren't marching or drilling. You were learning about weapons and stuff like that.
Where did they send you for training?
San Diego. Both my brother and I went to San Diego.
Are there some things that you picked up in that training more than 80 years ago that still stick with you today?
Teamwork. You're not an individual, and you're a team. You're one of a member. And there are no I's in team. And there's just some of the things I remember about it. But, you know, in boot camp, you're awakened early in the morning, and you go to late at night, and you're drilling, and they teach you everything about take personal hygiene and the whole works. And you're taught how to exist alone but work together as a team.
You know, you mentioned the draw to volunteer for the 1st Marine Paratrooper Unit was the pay. What was their recruiting pitch? How did you find out about this idea?
When you're in boot camp, they ask you what you want to do. They emphasize Cooks and Bakers School, for example, and different things like that. The paratroopers seemed the most encouraging because it paid more. But we never made any attempt to jump in combat, although we were trained for it.
Well, yeah, and so that's what I wanted to ask about. So I'm sure you did have some training jumps, and I've had a lot of pilots over the years say, why would anybody jump out of a perfectly good airplane? What was that like? I mean, that had to be a new experience for you.
Well, we jumped from 800 feet, and the static line of a plane was 75 feet, so you weren't really in the air all that long, about 13 seconds, and you were on the ground. But the physical training to it, you know, the running and everything was double time. I don't know, it was just physical training, and I wish I was in that good of physical shape now. I'd love to be that way again.
Well, I think you're doing pretty good for a guy eye on the century, Mark. So you finished that training, and while you know now, you guys never made any combat jumps. Obviously, you were prepared to do that, to jump behind enemy lines and fight your way out.
Yeah, we were trained to do that, but we landed right along with the Marine Corps Raider Battalion, you know, just like a regular Marine.
And where was that? Where was your first action?
First action was at Vela La Vela, a little island at the northern end of the Solomon Islands up by Bougainville. And I spent Thanksgiving on Vela La Vela in 1943 and Christmas on Bougainville in 1943. So, you know, that was pretty close together.
Well, a few questions come to mind. I want to circle back to those holidays, but I'm also interested, as you're heading overseas, what was going through your mind? Did you have confidence you were going to come back?
Of course. You think you're invincible when you're a Marine.
And your brother had already seen combat by then.
He had been on Guadalcanal, yeah, originally. He hit three of the big ones. He hit Guadalcanal, Peleliu, and then Okinawa, the final one. He was killed 3 days after his 21st birthday.
And I want to ask you about that. I'm curious if you heard anything from him about Guadalcanal or Peleliu.
No letters. He wouldn't write to me. He'd write home.
So you thought you were invincible. You go over there, Vela La Vela, and you're there for Thanksgiving. Is that a little surreal, marking Thanksgiving in a war zone?
Well, it's different, but, you know, it wasn't all that bad. It was mostly patrols and outposts.
Was there a welcome to the war moment or a first taste that really hit home?
There was a propagandist, a Tokyo Rose, they call her, and she played American music, popular music at that time, and the guys liked to listen to it. And she kept promising us a big surprise for Christmas Day. Well, Christmas Day in 1943, I woke up, and there was an earthquake going, and those big old mahogany trees were just quivering. And you didn't hear anything, no explosions or anything. And you thought, well, it's a surprise, but I don't know what's going on. But it was an earthquake, my first experience with an earthquake. It just, you know, just goes through your mind. Of course, put it into action right away and start having sergeants beller at you. So you didn't think about it too long.
When did it hit home to you? When did it sink in that you could be killed out here, that this is life and death?
When I saw my first dead Marine. It was a kid from Chicago, and I won't give his name, but we'd been on a patrol, stopped to clean our weapons. He was cleaning his weapon and accidentally shot and killed himself. And that was my first reality to the reality of war. Otherwise, it was just like playing cowboy and Indians.
And you told us what it was like on Vella La Vella as far as fairly low key in the perspective you have now. What about when you hopped over to Bougainville after that?
Well, that's when we started on long patrols and trains. And I remember one time the lieutenant says we're just going around the curvature of their swamp. It's kind of like walking around a saucer. And I remember going along on the trail, and one of the guys says, he said this was a saucer. He didn't tell us it was going to be filled full of dirty coffee. You know, the guys were always coming up with something to break the tension, even no matter where we were going. I remember when we were on the boats going into Iwo Jima. It was about 5 miles from where they let us off the ship till we got there. And those Amtrak things didn't move very fast. Seemed like it'd take forever to get there. And one of the guys, old Woody, he pipes up. He says, is this trip really necessary? You know, it breaks the tension.
Well, and there's a lot of time in between here, too, that I want to make sure I fill in the blanks there. So Christmas of 43, you're on Bougainville. Iwo Jima is not till February of 45. Right. What were you doing in between?
Well, between 43 and 45, well, 43, we're on Bougainville. And after Bougainville, we came home. And the paratroopers were disbanded, and we were put into the 5th Marine Division.
Did you have any feelings about that?
Well, you hated to lose, you know, use your setup. Up until that time, Ira Hayes was in my platoon in the paratroopers. And you know who Ira Hayes was.
Well, if you've studied the Battle of Iwo Jima, you do know who Ira Hayes was. One of the flag raisers atop Mount Suribachi. A moment in time that would etch his name into the history books, but also impact Hayes' life in a tragic way. It's time for our first break, but we'll hear Jim Friel's memories of Ira Hayes and also about the moment 78 years ago when Jim became one of the 27,000 Marine Corps casualties on Iwo Jima. That is a staggering number. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and a short video with Jim. And we'll be right back after this.